W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Polls show a statistical tie 17 days from Election Day, and early voting's now underway in all 50 states. And ABC's Mary Alice Park says those numbers show that engagement is high.
In really key battleground states, Georgia and North Carolina, election officials really like what they saw. They broke their turnout records for the first day of voting. Election officials say that it's a sign that people are energized, they are engaged, and that they trust the process with this election.
Today, Vice President Kamala Harris has campaign events in Detroit and Atlanta, while former President Donald Trump will campaign in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. In California, more than 15 million people are under fire weather alerts because of dry, windy conditions. Hundreds of people have been ordered to evacuate their homes in an Oakland neighborhood because of a fast-moving fire that broke out on Friday. At least one person was killed. 14 were hurt in rocket attacks launched from Lebanon towards northern Israel. This is ABC News. Trial of the man accused of murdering a federal judge delayed an order that requires Google to open its Android app store to more competition on hold until an appeals court decides the fate of the decision because of legal questions surrounding the jury verdict that deemed Google an illegal monopolist. NHTSA announced Friday it's going to investigate the full self-driving mode of about 2.4 million Tesla vehicles after reports of accidents in low visibility conditions. It's been a historic year for women's basketball, and the WNBA season is going all the way to the wire.
There will be a game five Sunday night in Brooklyn. 82-80.
The final moments on ESPN Friday as the Minnesota Lynx beat the New York Liberty 82-80 to force a winner-take-all game five in the WNBA finals that'll be played tomorrow in Brooklyn. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
When it comes to accurate, reliable election information for Wisconsin voters, visit the official site. It's myvote.wy.gov. It's the big cheese, you could say. It's your one-stop source for official Wisconsin election information. Find your polling place, see your sample ballot, make sure your registration is up to date, and more at myvote.wy.gov. Sponsored by Wisconsin Elections Commission, aired by Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was. When they moved the camera, whenever it's like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Yeah, lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The candidates for U.S. Senate in Wisconsin disagree over supporting Ukraine's defense against Russia. Democratic incumbent Tammy Baldwin and Republican challenger Eric Hovde debated Friday night. Baldwin supports the effort.
If Putin were allowed to run through Ukraine without our backing the Ukrainian troops, who's next? A NATO country? Poland? And that would mean U.S. boots on the ground.
Hovde says he's grown critical of the Ukrainian cause.
Well, I was supportive of Ukraine at first. The amounts of tens of billions of dollars that have gone to Ukraine that are not accountable causes great concern for me.
The race has tightened, and the outcome in Wisconsin could determine the balance of power in the entire U.S. Senate. Senator Baldwin's campaign has claimed Eric Hovde said older Americans should not vote. Here's Tricia Young with a Wisconsin Watch fact check.
A May 25th TV ad falsely claimed Eric Hovde said, quote, most seniors shouldn't vote, unquote, which he never stated. Hovde, running against U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin this November, discussed alleged voting irregularities in Wisconsin nursing homes during the 2020 election. He claimed most residents don't have the capacity to vote due to short life expectancy. However, many nursing home residents do vote, often with assistance. I'm Trisha Young for Wisconsin Watch. Learn more at wisconsinwatch.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunshine today, highs near 71 degrees. For tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 53. Southwest winds about 15 to 20 miles per hour. Sunday, sunshine, 77. Monday, sunny and 77. Partly sunny and 70 on Tuesday.
Currently, 53 degrees.
Maggie Dawn.
Next, I've got Michael Sozan, Senior Fellow for Democracy Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. We're going to discuss Trump's attacks on democracy. Don't miss it.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and I am here, Jim Santel, in broadcast stations of Civic Media at the headquarters of Civic Media for this weekend's broadcast right on the edges of the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, enjoying this beautiful day, this beautiful weekend in Wisconsin in the shadow of our Capitol Dome Farmers Market right down the street. Lots of wonderful activity going on today throughout the state of Wisconsin, including right here in Madison as well, joined in the studio, of course, by my superb producer. And along with him, I am taking your phone calls also at 844-967-2789. Delighted to have you join Sam and me for our discussion in this second hour of our broadcast. We're talking about updates on these various cases pending against Donald Trump, pretty much concluding our discussion about that matter, pending in front of Tanya Chutkan, the major assignments before her going forward, and this major decision that she made just this past week to release into the public domain a lot of the documents that give us an insight, a preview, if you will, into how this trial is going to look. Other things coming up, of course, with respect to Donald Trump's prosecution, including that case in New York, the case in Georgia, the case in southern Florida. At the end of our last segment, at the end of our first hour, caller Joe was identifying an issue that we're going to be talking about in the broadcast right before the election, and that is the implications of what could happen after November 5th when all of us go to the polls, many of us already going to the polls, absentee voting, early voting, encouraging that a lot in America to ensure you've got access to the polls, the franchise, the whole idea behind the Constitution, behind the Voting Rights Act of the 1960s, intended to extend the franchise to ensure that people have access to elect representatives that they support and ensuring that they are part of our democratic system. All of that also going to be a part of our discussion in the weekend broadcast right before the election, talking about the kinds of issues that Joe identified at the end of our last hour, implications not only under, yes, indeed, the 12th Amendment passed in the very early years of the 19th century in the wake of one of our first elections involving both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, June 15th, 1804, revising the mechanisms by which we elect a president and a vice president. That plainly amended somewhat, not constitutionally, but given more flesh, if you will, by recent legislative activity that ensures that it is governors, not legislatures, that will send the results of the Electoral College to the Washington, D.C. folks, the people of the National Archives, so that the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President of the Senate can get together again in early January and count those votes. But as Joe indicated, this date in December, when the electors themselves and through the processes established in the Constitution and under statute recently passed, all of them required basically to certify what happened in the state of Wisconsin and pass that on then to Washington, D.C. for counting in early January. We'll talk about what will happen on that day, other days in the near future, and then also other consequences depending upon what may happen on November 5th. Recourse to the courts, recourse to state courts, federal courts, maybe the Supreme Court as well. Maybe other mechanisms invoking other ways of addressing what may happen on November 5th. All of that, all of those kinds of things suggest strongly that although we will have an election, hopefully decisive and clear for the American public, regardless of your partisan view, regardless of your political leaning, some decision, some dispositive result of November 5th is a good thing. Question whether that will happen. And if indeed we're going to be spending some portion of November and December, maybe even to January as well, trying to figure out who exactly won this election. A lot of it depends upon voting and turnout and the decisions by the candidates themselves about what they may choose to do in the wake of the official election results on November 5th. We're going to talk more about what Joe raised, the amendment, the 12th Amendment, and other processes in our broadcast right before the election. And in our broadcast next week, we're going to talk about other things going on with respect to voting around the country. We're going to talk more about what's happening in state legislatures, some referendums out there, what's happening when it comes to elections commissions around the country, how all of that could also affect, again, in advance of November 5th, how all those kinds of machinations, all those kinds of official, some of them unofficial actions, may also have an impact upon the election of November 5th. All of that coming up, some program notes there for our next two broadcasts here on Amicus, a law review. We know as well that there are other things going on just this past week in connection with these cases against Donald Trump, the criminal cases. The hush money case itself, as you know well, resulted in the former president being found guilty by a jury. 34 counts of falsifying business records in that hush money criminal trial in front of Juan Merchan, who's overseeing that state case. Why is this back in the news just this past week? Well, you may recall, based upon our prior reporting and other discussions, that earlier, not too long ago, a few weeks ago, a U.S. District Court judge named Alvin Hellerstein, again in the Southern District of New York, rejected Donald Trump's request to move that state case, that state prosecution, that state conviction, which is heading toward a sentencing in late November, again, long after the election, to move that case from state court to federal court. And Hellerstein in particular ruled that Donald Trump didn't show good cause for why that should happen. And he wrote that nothing in the Supreme Court's opinion, he's talking once again about that immunity decision, affects my previous conclusion, he said, making reference to a previous finding of his, that the hush money payments that were the focus of that state prosecution there, nothing about those payments the previous conclusion that the hush money payments were private, unofficial acts outside the bounds of executive authority. Nothing about that should be overturned. His previous conclusion remains in place that everything related to that prosecution in front of Juan Merchan was a private matter, not plainly in the public domain, but something that is not within the ambit of a presidential act, nothing official about that. And for that reason, no movement, no removal of that state case into federal court rejecting that. Well, what happened just this past week? Donald Trump articulating the view that decision was wrong. And he has appealed that decision. He has appealed that decision to a federal appeals court, give him a second chance to argue that New York State hush money prosecution should be moved into federal court. His attorney is saying this. He said on September 3rd, the district court issued a conclusory statement, a remand order that misapplied binding precedent and statutory removal procedure, all that related to how a case can go under some circumstances from state court to federal court, alleging that the judge Hellerstein, ignored key evidence supporting the removal notice, misapprehended, Donald Trump's attorneys say, the obligation of federal courts to provide an unbiased federal forum for fair litigation of federal defenses pursuant to the federal officer removal statute. A lot to unpack there as well. The upshot is Donald Trump now arguing to the Court of Appeals that the decision by the federal judge not to remove that case from the state forum and move it into federal court, that was wrong. And so now seeking the appellate review of that decision as well. Again, an awful lot of people looking at this saying, no, indeed, that particular prosecution, perhaps somewhat related to the others, but that one in particular was at a time, for the most part, before Donald Trump was the president, a few actions, a few activities while he was the president in 2017. But all those things related to paying somebody off to be quiet in connection with a campaign, all of those private, all those personal in nature, intended, frankly, to deceive the American public, but also to affect the election. None of those official capacity kinds of things that the Supreme Court would otherwise embrace as perhaps being beyond the pale of prosecution. All of that now coming up again out of that New York State case, now on appeal, if you will, even as Judge Merchan says, no, I'm going to be sentencing Donald Trump. He's going to announce his own decision on whether or not this immunity order applies to the case. Presumably, he's likewise, like Judge Hellerstein, going to find that indeed there's no applicability to the Supreme Court case, nothing that prevents the overturning, the reversal of the trial results there. That's what Judge Merchan will almost certainly articulate right after the Thanksgiving holiday, late November, and then go on to sentence Donald Trump in November for that conduct that the jury found him guilty of. And that's going to happen. That will go ahead even as this appeal now from Donald Trump about the decision by the federal court not to remove that case from Judge Juan Merchan, not to take it away from him as that goes forward. There's a lot of machinations going on here. But that happened, again, just this past week. Administration of Justice, does he have a right to do that? Sure, he does. That's why the courts are open. That's why we've got a free and open judiciary in America. His petition, however, almost certainly to fall, not on deaf ears, the appeals court will take due concern and consideration of that, but almost certainly will support Judge Hellerstein's decision not to remove that case and let Judge Merchan go ahead and sentence Donald Trump in the wake of the guilty verdict against him. That happening again in New York just this past week. Then we've got some activity going to the South, going to that case involving Georgia election interference. That case also pending, as you know, in Georgia against Donald Trump and many other individuals. It is on appeal to a Georgia appeals court. There again, a state court there. And we know that part of that appeal is premised upon the decision by Donald Trump to appeal the decision by the district court there, his name is Scott McAfee, that found that Fani Willis, in connection with this relationship she had with her co-counsel, was indeed an appearance of impropriety, but not a conflict of interest that required that she be removed from the case. That's pending in front of the Court of Appeals. What else happened just this past week in that connection? Well, Fani Willis, kind of on the coattails of that, has also appealed the trial judge's dismissal of about six counts in the case. It happened a long time ago, including charges that related to Donald Trump's pressuring of the Georgia Secretary of State. You may recall well his name, Brad Raffensperger. And in particular, recall this event, the president telling Raffensperger on January 2nd that I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than what we have because we won the state. And that, among other things, a part of the original counts against Donald Trump there. And Fani Willis taking up on appeal the decision by Scott McAfee, the decision by the trial judge to dismiss those counts, six of them altogether, based upon the fact that they were insufficiently detailed, insufficiently specific, not providing the defendant with specific information about the charges against him. As we continue with our discussion, we'll talk about exactly what Fani Willis said to the appeals court just this past week and talk more about what happens in that case, that Georgia case, pending there in Fulton County and the appellate tribunal. All of that on Amicus, a law review.
This is the talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Hi, this is Jim Schmidt, your former mayor of Green Bay. You know, I've always cared about local issues. I still do. Join me on my new show, Lean Local, here on WGBW. I'll interview community leaders and elected officials, discuss the economy and development projects, and we'll talk about the future of education here in Greater Green Bay. As they say, all politics is local. So join me for Lean Local, Sunday at 1 p.m. on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 WGBW.
The
The Todd Alba Show.
Minority Rule. The author is Ari Berman.
If you look back at Wisconsin history, it gave rise to Social Security and unemployment insurance and collective bargaining. It really personified the idea that no matter what political party you were with, government should work for the common good. And Walker had a very different idea, that government should work for this conservative elite instead.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
This is Amicus, a law review. We are doing this weekend in our weekly broadcast a review, some analysis of where these cases are pending against Donald Trump, candidate for the presidency, hopes to be elected to the presidency in just a few days here in America. What's going on in all these cases? Talked already about this election interference case pending in front of Tanya Chutkan. Talked about his recent appeal of a decision not to remove that case from the state case from Judge Juan Merchan, take that into federal court. That's what the former president filed just this past week, unlikely to be successful, presuming, again, that Judge Merchan will not further reschedule things, anticipating not only an announcement by Judge Juan Merchan about his view of the applicability of the Supreme Court immunity case, but also, very significantly, in American history, sometime in late November, sentencing Donald Trump for the conviction entered against him by that jury a number of months ago, finding his engagement in conduct was violative of New York law. And then now discussing what's going on in Georgia, recognizing that the appeals court there in Georgia right now is reviewing this decision again by Scott McAfee. He's the state court judge there in that forum, who said that, you know, Fannie Willis does not need to be taken off the case, engage in some behavior that raises concerns, appearance of impropriety, but no conflict of interest. And that decision by the lower court judge, the trial court judge, not to remove her and her office from the prosecution, that's what Donald Trump has now appealed to the appeals court there. And it's pending there right now. And along the way, Fannie Willis said, you know, as long as we're there before the appeals court, I'm also going to appeal another decision that was entered by Scott McAfee, dismissing some 6 counts of this omnibus indictment, crimes involving solicitation of violation of oath by public officers. The judge had ruled there that those specific counts there, insufficiently detailed to go ahead, not providing the defendant, Donald Trump, with enough notice, which is a part of our process as well, so that he can defend properly against it. Fannie Willis pushing back on that notion and filing just this past week in the appeals court that's already reviewing this issue about whether she continues to prosecute the case. She is also appealing that related but separate decision by Scott McAfee to dismiss those counts. Here's what she says to the appeals court. She says, consideration of cases from other jurisdictions, which is appropriate due to the lack of Georgia precedent. There, what she's bemoaning is the fact that when it comes to all these kinds of things, Georgia case law does not provide some clear analogies or clear directions on these kinds of things. So you need to go to other places, find other sources of authority, she said. But looking at those other sources makes clear, she says, that the details of a target crime are not required, she says, to be pleaded with particularity so long as a defendant is placed on notice of what his own conduct is at issue that constituted solicitation. Again, the solicitation of violation of an oath of office by a public officer. She goes on to say that the facts and context from other counts of this omnibus indictment that do remain not the subject of any attack, aside from the substantive attack against the facts underlying them, she says none of those, the facts and the context of all that, gives the defendant enough details. All of that does provide the defendant with enough details. None of those counts is inadequate to provide Donald Trump with notice of what he is charged with. She goes on to say, for example, they point to the racketeering count in the indictment, which ties into the rest of the case regarding the overarching goal of the alleged conspiracy, unlawfully changing the outcome of the 2020 presidential election in Georgia in favor of Trump. What she's arguing there to the appeals court is that in context, with all the other counts, all the language that remains in this omnibus indictment against Donald Trump and against many others, including some who pled guilty already. All of that provides context. All of that provides Donald Trump with sufficient notice. And Scott McAfee was wrong, is what she's saying. He was wrong in dismissing those counts. The indictments as to those counts can continue and can go to trial whenever Scott McAfee decides to put this on the docket, whenever the Court of Appeals determines that indeed, as it probably will, that Fannie Willis can continue to prosecute this case. But right now, virtually all of that also suspended is the Court of Appeals' actions on both those counts and also about the disqualification of Fannie Willis continues to be under advisement by the appeals court. The appeals court itself is, in fact, soliciting not only documents but also oral argument from the parties. And as a part of this routine process that we see in all of these cases, we'll make a determination then about whether or not Scott McAfee was right or wrong and presumably send that case then back to him for further proceedings that are consistent with whatever the appeals court says. Lots going on there as well. Lots to unpack there as well. And finally, in the category of things having to do with that fourth case, that is the case in Mar-a-Lago. It is in Fort Pierce, which is the Southern District of Florida. We're back to a federal case, another federal case being prosecuted by Jack Smith. A significant thing happening just this past week that underscores this larger issue that with respect to three of these four cases, no time soon will there be a trial of any of them. We know that that case, this is the Mar-a-Lago case, this is the classified and other secure documents charges against Donald Trump that allege that he improperly retained them, moved them around, bandied them about, had them even after multiple attempts to recover them from him. What happened just this past week is that two key prosecutors in the office of Jack Smith, the special counsel's office, who've been there from the start, very experienced people. One of them is named Julie Edelstein. She played a prominent role in the early court hearings in these document cases. Very, very good, studied, experienced, wonderful a prosecutor there. And a second one named David Raskin, also a veteran prosecutor, handled intelligence-related cases in the past. Both of them a part of this process in front of Judge Eileen Cannon there as this case was going through the process at the trial court. Now that Judge Cannon, as you well know, has dismissed that case, and that case now on appeal by the government to the appeals court there, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, almost certainly going to reverse her once again and tell her, Eileen Cannon, you cannot do this. Send it back almost certainly at some point in the not too distant future, telling her that this decision that she made, that somehow the prosecutor did not have the authority to do what he was doing, is simply wrong. While that is pending, however, these two major veteran prosecutors have announced that they're leaving special counsel's office, not in any way because they're not committed to the notion of justice going forward in this case, not because they have some concerns about the theories of the prosecution, but simply because, although they have not gone public about this, that there's no trial date in the anticipated near future. And so they've gone back, if you will, to their other assignments. Julie Edelstein in the counterintelligence section, David Raskin in the security division of the Justice Department, still Department of Justice, but they're trial attorneys, and they're waiting for the trial, which Eileen Cannon, again, has delayed and now basically suspended almost indefinitely while this thing is pending on appeal. These two very good attorneys, they can be called back up again at an appropriate time, but they're going back to their own assignments because they're waiting for the time when they will be permitted to do what they do, which is try these cases, try the counts alleging that Donald Trump and others not only engaged in obstruction of justice in connection with that investigation, but also, again, improperly retained and used and stored these documents to which he had no lawful entitlement. They're returning to their old jobs inside the Department of Justice, waiting for that day when somebody, an appeals court judge, tells them that the trial is back on at the district court level and proceedings can go forward. As we continue here on Amicus, we're going to turn to the United States Supreme Court. Stay with us for that discussion.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Polls show a statistical tie 17 days from Election Day, and early voting's now underway in all 50 states. And ABC's Mary Alice Park says those numbers show that engagement is high.
In really key battleground states, Georgia and North Carolina, election officials really like what they saw. They broke their turnout records for the first day of voting. Election officials say that it's a sign that people are energized, they are engaged, and that they trust the process with this election.
Today, Vice President Kamala Harris has campaign events in Detroit and Atlanta, while former President Donald Trump will campaign in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. In California, more than 15 million people are under fire weather alerts because of dry, windy conditions. Hundreds of people have been ordered to evacuate their homes in an Oakland neighborhood because of a fast-moving fire that broke out on Friday. At least one person was killed, 14 were hurt in rocket attacks launched from Lebanon towards northern Israel. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
A showdown for the Packers and Texans. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Packers host the Houston Texans tomorrow at noon. I asked Green Bay running back Josh Jacobs at 5-1. Just how good is this Texans team?
We viewing this as a playoff matchup. I mean, you know, that team over there, even though they're in the AFC, they have a really good team. I think that probably at the end of the year, they're probably going to finish, you know, top four in the AFC. So we viewing it as a playoff matchup, you know, see where we at right now and see where they at.
Former NFL linebacker D'Amico Ryans has turned around the Texans franchise in his first year as their head coach and talked about Packers quarterback Jordan Love.
Yeah, watching the tape on Jordan Love, I think, you know, he's really very, very good quarterback. Talk about putting the ball where he wants it, like his pinpoint accuracy, like really good. It's going to be a big challenge. Everybody just has to maintain their focus, eye discipline, rush discipline.
That's Texans head coach D'Amico Ryans with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunshine today, highs near 71 degrees. For tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 53. Southwest winds about 15 to 20 miles per hour. Sunday, sunshine, 77. Monday, sunny and 77. Partly sunny and 70 on Tuesday.
Right now, it's 55.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Dom Salvia Show.
And I heard the scientists say the other day that when a man votes for a woman, he actually transitions into a woman.
What Jesse happens Water. When a woman votes for a man?
Turns into a man.
Well, that's okay, though.
That's fine.
Yeah, because then she gets control of her body.
Oh.
I see what I did there?
Yeah.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Carl Sarecki from Door County Trolley. Have you ever lost anybody on one of the tours?
The question really isn't did you lose people or did you gain them? True story, one of our drivers.
So he gets home, picked up a spirit along the tour.
Yeah, he's in bed, and then all of a sudden the treadmill starts up on him.
See, if I were a ghost, I think I would just get liposuction. I don't think I would mess around with cardio.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On Monday's show, we'll find out what 9-year-old podcaster Beckett Kay's got to say about Sunday's game.
And we'll check in with Mike Pritzel and get an update on hurricane relief efforts in Florida.
Join us.
Weekday mornings, 6 till 9.
Mm-hmm. This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. This is our continuing discussion of all things related to justice and courts and the rule of law in the United States of America, here in the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Turning, as we have in the past, to our United States Supreme Court, obviously having a huge impact not only upon our daily lives and livelihoods, but also upon things related to the present campaign for the presidency, as we have been spending a lot of time talking about that this weekend as well. Supreme Court, as I've indicated, is now in its new term. This is the 2024-2025 term after a very tumultuous, a very, very historic session just concluded in late September, finding, among other things, that, again, a president is immune from crimes committed in office. Also, this major decision under Loper Bright Enterprises, that's the name of the Supreme Court case, that changed the way in which our federal courts interact with federal agencies, finding for the first time in 40 years that federal courts are no longer obliged, or at least encouraged strongly, to defer to the brightness, the expertise, the insight, the intelligence, the experience of people who know what they're talking about inside federal agencies, and instead drop-kicking what's called Chevron deference and saying, nope, judges can make those decisions. They've got enough insight themselves. Loper Bright Enterprises changing the way in which government works, changing the way in which citizens in the United States of America interact with the federal agencies with which they have business as well. No small consequences to the term just completed, and no small consequences to the term now underway. Already in the term beginning on October 7th, 9 different oral arguments, 9 different times when members of the Supreme Court questioning, peppering lawyers in front of them with questions and comments about the merits and demerits of their positions. If you have the chance ever to go to Washington, D.C., stand in line, watch some of the oral arguments. It's worth it to see government in action. It's worth it to see our Supreme Court justices in action in person. If you can't do that, you can go online and also hear these oral arguments live. The Chief Justice has made that accessible to all of us. You can also go online and hear the recorded oral arguments as well. You can hear their actual voices. You can hear them exchange views, many times opposing views, with each other and certainly with counsel in front of them. All the times that I recite what justices are saying from the bench, those are from transcripts taken from those actual oral arguments. And so it's much better, much more compelling to hear the yin and the yang, the back and forth between the attorneys and the court, and sometimes, again, members of the court itself with each other, sparring and sometimes agreeing with each other on the merits of cases in front of them. 9 oral arguments already in the couple of weeks of this term. Last week, we talked about 2 of the 5 cases that the oral arguments were scheduled for, and that included Garland versus Vanderstock, this case in which it appears that a majority of the Supreme Court, including, yes, that's right, the Chief Justice and also Amy Coney Barrett, Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett from the Seventh Circuit, finding almost certainly, probably not deciding until May or June of next year, that ghost guns can in fact be regulated to ensure that there are serial numbers, that they're memorialized for future tracing by law enforcement. Plainly a win for law enforcement, but also for people in our nation, all people in our nation who are concerned about gun safety and security in all aspects of our lives. A second case last week also highlighted called Glossop. It's one of these death penalty cases. There are more of those coming up later in this docket involving whether or not Mr. Glossop, who was previously convicted of admittedly a heinous crime involving the murder of a hotel owner, whether he should get a new trial based upon some recently discovered information that suggests strongly that the prosecution knew about some exculpatory, at least some information about the principal witness against Mr. Glossop that was not disclosed to him. And so the Supreme Court had oral argument on that, almost certainly sending that case back to Oklahoma for a rehearing or perhaps even a retrial. He is on death row right now, a death penalty case based upon the validity and the strength of the evidence presented during the course of that trial. Just this past week, the Supreme Court had 4 more oral arguments on Tuesday and Wednesday. One of those on Wednesday having to do with a very important issue coming out of the Court of Appeals for Veterans Affairs, having to do with a thing called the benefit of the doubt rule. Veterans benefits in a case called Bufkin versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. That was argued on Wednesday morning. three other cases we're going to highlight right now involving the environment, involving immigration, and involving medical marijuana. Let's start with that one in particular. This past Tuesday, the Supreme Court entertained oral argument in a case called Medical Marijuana, Inc. versus Horn. H-O-R-N, Douglas Horn is the name of the petitioner. How does this case come about? Well, it started after Mr. Horn came across an article in a thing called the High Times, a magazine that covers the business and the culture of marijuana. He was looking at an ad about a wellness product called Dixie X, and was said to be rich in CBD, which, of course, is a component of hemp that does not produce the so-called high that's associated with marijuana, but was advertised as containing 0% THC, which, of course, is the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis. And knowing that he faced some random drug tests because he's a commercial truck driver, Mr. Horn conducted some additional research, and he watched some YouTube videos, and he visited the manufacturer's website, and he called the company's toll-free number, and they confirmed that the product contained no THC. And then after using it, based upon those representations, Mr. Horn failed a drug test and he was fired as a truck driver. And he suspected, of course, that the product was to blame. And he bought another bottle and had that tested. The testing company found that it did, in fact, contain the THC that Mr. Horn was concerned about from the very start. And he sent it back. He tried to get that tested, and the company refused to mail it back to Mr. Horn. He sued under RICO, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act, a law that, of course, was initially intended to go after organized crime officials. And Mr. Horn maintaining, among other things, that the defendant's racketeering activity injured him in his business or his property. And that phrase, and the reason why this case is important, is that phrase, according to the Supreme Court, excludes suits for personal injuries. Personal injuries not subject to RICO prosecution in this civil remedy. He sues three defendants, Medical Marijuana, Inc., Dixie Holdings, and Red Dice Holdings, says they've engaged in this RICO activity through this enterprise that included mail and wire fraud both. A federal trial court dismissed his claim, saying that his claim was purely personal. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Second Circuit says no. They reversed the lower court. And they say that the phrase business or property focuses on the nature of the harm and not the source of the harm itself. And for that reason, they reinstate the case. And it gets up to the Supreme Court then. And the question before the Supreme Court just this past Tuesday, in this case involving medical marijuana, at least that's the name of the company, this THC issue, the CBD issue, all those kinds of things, is whether or not the harm that Mr. Horn, Douglas Horn, suffered during the course of this odyssey in which he lost his job because he took this drug believing it did not contain any THC, whether that was personal in nature, that harm, or whether it was a part of his business or property. Ketanji Brown Jackson saying he's not claiming that he got ill because of the product. He's not saying that he was personally injured. He didn't even know that he had ingested THC until the testing and the firing. She, of course, is advocating for the notion that his case should go ahead, because indeed he's alleged a business or property damage. Elena Kagan said the defendants were fighting on the wrong battleground. She said, if you're harmed when you lose a job, she said, then you've been injured in your business. And she said the better argument, one that's not before the court in this oral argument or the case generally, was the defendants had not caused Mr. Horn's injury directly, sort of a causation issue. And in lawyers speak, that's proximate cause, proximate causation, prompting Clarence Thomas again on the bench just this past Tuesday to make the point this way. He said, medical marijuana did not fire you. And, of course, the discussion goes on. Sam Alito says, he sounds doubtful about all this. He says, wouldn't you argue that a company that advertises its product as being completely free of THC, not just that it is only such an infinitesimal amount that's not going to get people high, but is completely free of THC, Alito argues, is appealing to a category of potential customers who, for some reason, want to make sure that they didn't ingest even a tiny, tiny amount of THC. And when someone, he says, who purchases that product and then suffers the consequences of having that THC in their system, that is an entirely foreseeable result. Again, talking about this causation issue. again, a lot of discussion among the Supreme Court justices about how the case should be litigated, whether or not this business or property standard under RICO has been met. We'll see what the Supreme Court says with respect to Douglas Horn's claim, whether they support it, whether they send it back, or whether they say, no, no, this is completely personal, and for that reason, you lose and do not have a claim in the court to go ahead. That case, Medical Marijuana versus Horn, H-O-R-N, argued just this past Tuesday. The Supreme Court also taking up some other cases, again, in the area of immigration and also a case involving the environment. Let's talk about that immigration case in particular. The U.S. Supreme Court seemed skeptical again on Tuesday, the same day that they were reviewing the medical marijuana case, skeptical of a challenge that comes from a United States citizen. And she is challenging in particular her spouse's revocation of a visa that's granted to him. And as a result of that activity, the case comes into court and lands up on the Supreme Court's docket. And so what happens here in particular is that the immigration authorities revoked the visa of her non-citizen spouse after they found out that that spouse had previously engaged in a sham marriage. Previous events and previous indications that he engaged in fraud when it comes to immigration for the purpose of getting that previous immigration benefit. U.S. citizens, lawful personnel, folks, some residents here, can apply for a visa for their immediate relatives, like a spouse, as did this particular petitioner. The spouse is named Amina Bouarfa, B-O-U-A-R-F-A. She's a U.S. citizen, and she sought this visa for her spouse. And his name is Ala Hamayel, H-A-M-A-Y-E-L. He's a Palestinian national. And again, according to the law, U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents can do that, can get visas for their non-citizen spouses. The couple here, they married in 2011. They have three children. What happened was that Bouarfa's application for a visa for Hamayel initially granted and then was revoked by the immigration authorities after they found out, they did some investigation, evidence showing that Hamayel had allegedly entered into a previous marriage in an effort to evade immigration laws after one of his two previous ex-wives testified that the union there was fraudulent. This is going back in history and finding that you've engaged in some previous fraud with respect to immigration. And interestingly, she later recanted that testimony, said, no, that wasn't true at all. So a very, very mixed record on all this, which probably in part gets it to the Supreme Court. What happens is they appeal. After their appeal to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, USCIS, was unsuccessful after they revoked, again, this visa, Bouarfa challenged the revocation of that visa in federal court. You go into federal court, say, you know what? The federal authorities have improperly dealt with my visa application. USCIS revoking the visa, that conduct was wrong. That's what she alleges. A district court in Florida dismisses her claim, finding that that visa would be within the discretionary authority of immigration officials to do, and that Congress has limited the ability of courts to interfere in these kinds of circumstances. That's kind of the rub in all this case. The same court also found, interestingly, kind of looking at the merits of this, highly troubled, it said, by the potential implications of this ruling, expressing concerns that, in theory, the agencies, by doing this, again, by revoking a visa and then evading judicial review, could dodge judicial review by granting petitions and then revoking them rather than denying them outright. A lot of that procedural history. The 11th Circuit upheld that court's decision, getting us now to the Supreme Court. Bouarfa asked the high court to intervene, and she said that it was senseless and arbitrary if a mistake in the agency's original decision meant that her husband's visa and the permanent separation of her family could not be reviewed. Sort of a jurisdictional issue about what the courts can and cannot review in connection with an initial grant of a visa as opposed to a revocation of a visa. So what happens along the way, of course, is as oral argument. Again, this happens just in Tuesday of this past week. Sam Alito, other justices across the ideological spectrum appeared skeptical of this claim that the reversal should be reviewed by federal courts and appeared focused rather on this question of the scope of the immigration agency's discretion to revoke visas, Alito suggesting that there's a problem here. We'll talk more about that as...
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
Sweet chocolate reward. Sweet chocolate reward.
This is not just the sound of someone picking up a sweet treat at Walgreens. This is the sound of someone picking up a sweet treat right after receiving all their vaccines in one trip. This is the sound of treating yourself, because you protected yourself.
Stop by or schedule both your flu and COVID-19 vaccines today and grab yourself a sweet treat while you're at it. Vaccine subject to availability. State, age, and health-related restrictions may apply.
There was a time when barbecue was perfect. A strong, reliable flavor that could be counted on. But then big manufacturers decided that barbecue needed to be zesty or spicy or sweeter or whatever. If you miss the good old days of great-tasting barbecue, we'd like to introduce you to Grandpa's Barbecue. Made in small batches from Grandpa's original recipe. Buy yours online today at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We're continuing to talk about what the Supreme Court has reviewed just this past week, reviewing in particular this immigration case involving the decision by the Secretary of Homeland Security, the immigration folks, case called Bouarfa, B-O-U-A-R-F-A, versus Mayorkas. He is the Secretary, of course, of Homeland Security. During the course of oral argument, the court wrestling with the jurisdiction that it has to review revocations of a visa previously granted as opposed to initial denials of a grant. Sounds very wonky, sounds very legal, and it all is. Sam Alito suggesting that courts have the power to review an initial rejection of visa applications, but not their revocation, and argues that the statute, the federal statute, confers about the broadest measure of discretion that you could imagine. Elena Kagan said the decision to revoke is just different from the decision to approve or deny in the first instance. John Roberts has suggested that Bouarfa could file a new visa application that would be subject to judicial review if and when it was denied. Again, interesting case, not only because of the sort of wonky procedural history here and the language of the particular statute, but determination of this immigration status generally, having to do not only with foreign-born spouses, people asking for immigration status here in the United States upon the application of their citizen spouse, has a larger implication for how the Supreme Court is going to be interpreting immigration law, not only in this term, but also in the future. A big immigration case, Bouarfa, B-O-U-A-R-F-A versus Mayorkas, pending before the Supreme Court, probably going to be deciding in favor of Homeland Security. But we'll see once again, along with these other cases, in June of this coming year. And finally, on Wednesday of this past week, in addition to reviewing that VA case, the court also had in front of it a very interesting case involving the environment. Justices heard oral argument on Wednesday in a sort of a long simmering dispute between San Francisco, the city itself, and the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, over the regulation of water pollution. Appeared to side with San Francisco, the majority of the justices appearing to favor the arguments made by the city of San Francisco that were challenging the EPA attempts to enforce the law. The case is at its core about human waste and how San Francisco disposes of it, specifically whether the Clean Water Act of 1972 allows the EPA to impose generic prohibitions on wastewater released into the Pacific Ocean and to penalize the city. And the city coming back in response to a question by Clarence Thomas, he asks, with this permit, that is to release pollutants into the adjacent waters, with this permit, what is at bottom the problem? And the attorney for the city says, what is at bottom the problem, Mr. Justice, is that permit holders, specifically the city, don't know what they need to do to comply. She added that city officials don't have clear guidance about how to comply with what the EPA is telling them to do. They can't comply with a federal permit aimed at determining how much wastewater can be released without running afoul of the federal law, the Clean Water Act. Under the current EPA requirements, counsel said to the Supreme Court, San Francisco is exposed to crushing criminal civil penalties for these releases, even when it complies with its 300-page permit. We need to know, she says, more about exactly what the EPA requires and doesn't require. The EPA, of course, for its own part, through an assistant solicitor general, contends that the EPA has the power to issue broad guidelines and that nothing about what the city of San Francisco is complaining about is problematic. All of that, according to the transcript, again, coming out of this oral argument just on Wednesday of this past week. The case, once again, is San Francisco versus Environmental Protection Agency. It's a departure from more recent challenges to the EPA. Normally, we think about these in a different setting, brought by attorneys sometimes in states that directly seek to curtail the agency's power. Here, San Francisco, even though it's contesting what the EPA has done or not done in providing some clear direction here on what should happen in the future, San Francisco sued the EPA, frankly, a long time ago, during the Trump administration. And officials have pushed back on this idea that this case is somehow a challenge to the federal government's ability to regulate the environment generally. Recall, we've talked a lot about that in the context of the Chevron doctrine and deference to agencies like the EPA. San Francisco maintaining, no, we're not saying that the agency cannot regulate the environment. Our challenge, rather, is that we've got to clarify exactly what we've got to do and what we don't have to do. Got to clarify the provisions, they're saying, of the city's wastewater permit so that San Francisco can comply with the Clean Water Act. We can abide by the law and do what is required under those permits, under the law. We want to comply, they say. And we went on to say, without that information about exactly what EPA is requiring us to do, the attorney for the city said during the course of oral argument, we're basically flying blind as to how we're going to tell exactly what San Francisco should do to protect water quality. Again, arguably raising some Chevron issues, but really not a contest, if you will, between the city and the EPA. Interestingly, in terms of reading the tea leaves here, another very, very, not curious, but different kind of take on how the justices are coming down. Many of the so-called liberal justices coming down on the side of the EPA and saying, yes, indeed, these broad applications under this permit are in fact permissible. An awful lot of conservative justices during the course of oral argument who are seemingly aligned with San Francisco, sort of known, again, not lost on anybody doing some court watching here, that San Francisco, among the cities in America best known as sort of a liberal bastion, apparently getting an awful lot of support just this past week from the United States Supreme Court, including some of the conservative justices who say, you know what, San Francisco, you've got a good argument here. You've got a good basis upon which to contest what the EPA is doing, supporting probably in the end, a decision that may come down in favor of the city of San Francisco. Again, not attempting to undermine the EPA's authority, but asking for more clarity in terms of what it does and should not do in terms of these human waste releases into the waters in and around the Pacific Ocean there and the penalties that go along with that. All of that pending in front of the United States Supreme Court just this past week. We know as well the Supreme Court has 40 cases altogether in front of it, and that includes some upcoming arguments and one coming right out of Wisconsin, November 4th, right before the election. One of the next days, the Supreme Court's going to be hearing oral arguments. A case involving Wisconsin Bell versus United States has to do with the FCC's Schools and Libraries Universal Support Program. Question about whether what claims are under the False Claims Act, that coming up. Wouldn't be talking about those and other cases as Amicus LawReview continues on the broadcast stations in future weekends. Stay with us and join us for those important discussions. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
Pete Schwaba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Travel Wisconsin's Logan Rogie, who joins the show to discuss fall hotspots in our beautiful state. And we'll go back to the future with a discussion about Back to the Future.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.